This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a recent $6.2 million jury verdict over the tasering death of a California man.
Finally, a major verdict against Taser International, a major verdict for a taser that killed someone.
We'll talk with veteran civil rights attorney Len Wineglass about the recent 11th Circuit Court decision in the case of the Cuban Five.
How many more years can this political outrage continue? Five Cuban patriots in jail for trying to save their country from terrorism, and courts that are more and more political, giving decisions that really shouldn't even be published in any law book.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
As we're sure most of our listeners have heard, on June 12th, last week, the Supreme Court came down with the decision we've all been waiting for in the Guantanamo cases. It was a 5-4 decision, which is roughly what we expected. We just didn't know which way the five would go. But luckily for the Guantanamo detainees, the five in the majority held in the most uncertain terms, in the most vivid terms, in the most extraordinary terms, that those detained at Guantanamo some 6.5 years have a constitutional right to go to court and test their detention. In other words, they upheld the writ of habeas corpus for those at Guantanamo. For me personally, it was an extraordinary development. I can recall the day, really, November 14th, 2001, when the president issued his military order saying that people could be taken to offshore penal facilities and held without the writ of habeas corpus. At that point, the center decided to make the first test of that law. It took us 6.5 years to finally get the Supreme Court to say unequivocally, no ifs, ands, or buts, people imprisoned at Guantanamo get the writ of habeas corpus. You all remember, of course, this is the third time, not once, not twice, but the third time that we've been to the Supreme Court on behalf of Guantanamo detainees. The other two cases that went up were done on a statutory basis. The Supreme Court didn't go to the core of the issue, the constitutional basis for the great writ or the writ of habeas corpus. Sadly, in both those former instances, the Republican Congress, joined unfortunately by many Democrats, overrode the Supreme Court's statutory decisions and left us with no choice, and really left the Supreme Court with no choice, but to go for the heart of the matter. Does the Constitution protect non-citizens imprisoned at Guantanamo during a so-called war on terror? And does it in particular protect their right to go into a court and put the government on the defensive? The government has to come forward and say, by a preponderance of the evidence, we have sufficient evidence legally and factually to hold you. So it's an extraordinary decision, really to be celebrated. But we also have to not forget it took 6.5 years of torture, coercion, continuing as I speak to you, at Guantanamo. And we also have to remember the reactions that this country has had to that. In fact, the reactions to this decision, particularly by the Republicans, are so extreme, and particularly that we had a 5-4 decision, to make you very worried about where this country is going. McCain, the putative so-called, well, I don't know what to call him. I don't know if you even call him a sheep in wolf's clothing. The guy's just a wolf. He called it one of the worst decisions in the history of this country. Think about that. a decision that simply and merely gives a right that goes back to the year 1215 to people detained in an offshore prison facility, McCain calls one of the worst decisions in the history of this country. As someone on one of our blogs that we work on Guantanamo said, in light of that comment and others that said, well, terrorists don't deserve rights, but of course, how do you know they're terrorists? But someone said, well, it sounds a little like the Dred Scott decision. You may all remember the Dred Scott decision. That's when they said that human beings could be bought and sold as if they were chattels. It took place in the late 1800s. It was a post-Civil War decision, not really overruled until 1954 in Brown v. Board. And as the quote that came up on my blog with regard to how people like McCain, how people like Lindsey Graham, how others are treating this decision, what was said in the Dred Scott decision of blacks is, quote, they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Think about that. They, blacks, had no right which the white man was bound to respect. And that's really what McCain is saying. That's what Senator Lindsey Graham is saying. Senator Lindsey Graham has gone so far to say we may need a constitutional amendment here to override this idea that non-citizens at Guantanamo, which is complete jurisdiction and control under the United States, that Guantanamo should not be subject to the U.S. Constitution. Of course, he won't get anywhere on a constitutional amendment. There's really nothing much, finally, that the government can do to overcome this decision. It's a constitutional decision. But that doesn't mean we're home free yet. You know, you feel like Sisyphus, that guy who pushes the rock up the hill, and each time the Bush administration pushes it back over your head. Well, this time it's a constitutional decision. They won't be able to do that, but they're already, Bush's statement is already saying, I disagree with the decision, and I want to get possibly legislation to do something. Well, you know, the only legislation that would be permitted, and it's a narrow exception, is if Congress set up a process which was an adequate substitute for habeas. That's the key language. It has to be really the equivalent of habeas. And I think they're unlikely to do that for a number of reasons. One, that's giving people a great deal of rights. Secondly, it's unlikely, I think, at this point, as frightened as the Democrats are on these national security issues, that they're going to actually collaborate with the Republicans to strip out the right of habeas corpus by substituting an adequate substitute. And I think that's particularly likely because Barack Obama actually made a very strong statement saying he was pleased at the decision, pleased to uphold the writ of habeas corpus. And I think with his leadership on the issue, that it's very, very unlikely now that they'll be able to do much about this decision. That doesn't mean they won't delay it, because let's bring it up to where we are. We have 270 people left at Guantanamo. We have petitions for writs of habeas corpus, or in other words, lawsuits filed in the Washington, D.C. federal court asking the government to justify each of the detentions. Even as I speak to you, some of the 600 lawyers working with the Center for Constitutional Rights on these cases have already gone into court and asked for status conferences, discovery, and are beginning the process of trying to get hearings. So we're going to try and move very rapidly. But of course, it's going to be just like the Bush administration to try and delay, to try and come up with different schemes for delaying, saying that some of this evidence is state secret, some of it is classified, we can't do this, we can't do that, we have to look for this. So my guess is, despite the rapidity that the Supreme Court has asked for and required, and some of the reason they went this way in this decision, they were just very angry at 6.5 years of delay, particularly after the 2004 Razul decision, which the center won, in which the court thought it was relatively clear that the people at Guantanamo should have rights. So they're angry about it. At the same time, there are many ways to delay, and I'm not clear that this administration won't see its goal as handing this problem to the next administration, whether it be McCain or Obama. At the same time, of the 270 people there, 60 have already been cleared for release. The U.S. has not been willing to release them. It hasn't been willing to make the arrangements to have those people released with other countries. This may put pressure on them. I also think as we move toward hearings in these cases, many of these people will be freed because there's no evidence. These were alleged terrorists, but in fact, there was no proof. Many of them were picked up by bribes. In fact, to the extent there might be, quote, evidence, it's from coercion, torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, I doubt they can keep a handful of cases against the 260 or 70 people that we at the center and other attorneys represent. Now, I don't want people to get mixed up between these cases and the cases before the military commissions. Military commissions are essentially faux or kangaroo-type criminal proceedings that are currently underway at Guantanamo for perhaps a dozen or more people. While those cases are affected by this recent Supreme Court case, the Bemidian 5-4 decision, they're affected in the way that the defendants in those cases might very well be able to bring habeas corpus cases now and try and get their criminal cases thrown out through habeas corpus. On the other hand, sometimes the federal courts require you to go through the criminal trials. So that we're talking about those dozen cases, and if you look at what the administration is now saying, what they're really pushing on is those cases. They say, oh, this new recent Supreme Court decision doesn't really affect our ability to try these people in these military commissions. That's the dozen people up for trial. We want to try up to 80. So we'll see. My guess is none of those cases will ultimately be upheld or finish their trials. It's been 6.5 years the administration has tried to use military commissions. It's been struck down once previously in the Supreme Court. Those military commissions don't resemble courts of anything that any of us would recognize, nor any justice system in the world would recognize. So it's my guess is those trials, if they can complete any of them before the new administration, I think is unlikely. I would hope, and of course this is not as secure, that Obama, if he wins, will decide that you can't use military commissions to try people, that you should be using, as was used in the 93 World Trade Center trials and is used in many other alleged terrorist trials in the United States, use regular federal courts in the United States. In any case, it's great news to bring everybody an important victory, really important. I have to tell you, when I read it, I just had big tears in my eyes because this has been really the effort of mine, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and of course now some 600 allies across the country in trying to find a way to undo one of the major building blocks of the police state. And we may have done it, even if we did it 5-4.
Here on Law & Disorder, we've talked with many guests on the dangers of taser stun guns. Recently, Taser International Incorporated, the largest stun gun maker, lost a $6.2 million jury verdict over the death of a California man who died after police shot him multiple times with the weapon. This is the first defeat for Taser International in a product liability claim. A San Jose, California jury says that Taser failed to warn the police of Salinas, California, that prolonged exposure to Taser's electric shock could cause a risk of heart attack. The 40-year-old victim, Robert Heston, died February 20, 2005, after his father called Salinas police because his son was acting strangely and seemed to be on drugs, according to the lawsuit complaint. The lawsuit claimed that Salinas police shot Heston multiple times with a stun gun, continuing to discharge their tasers into him until he stopped moving. Today we talk with civil rights attorney John Burton, who litigated the case. John, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're very pleased, especially because we've covered the issue of tasers in the context of torture and lack of training. So we're really happy to hear about this verdict. I understand this was a product liability claim. Can you explain sort of the thrust of the lawsuit and what this means?
Yes. Our theory was that tasers, when cycled repeatedly or in a prolonged manner, way beyond the 5 seconds that they're designed for, can cause metabolic changes that induce fatal cardiac arrest.
Had anyone ever brought that theory forward before?
Well, I think it had been raised, but this is actually only the second time a taser products liability case had gone to trial. And the first one involved only 5 cycles. Ours involved 25 of these 5 second cycles. So it really isolated this problem. And there's been new research published in 2005 and 2007 on pigs, which demonstrates that this effect is very real and very deadly.
I read something from the police PARC, the organization in California that mentioned that Taser International had met with a group of coroners and said that if they said that tasers contributed or were the primary cause of death, they would sue them. I've heard other anecdotal information about sort of the strong arm tactics of Taser. Did you, in doing your research and preparing for the case, have difficulties and obstacles in gathering information?
Well, the coroner that did the autopsy in this case, actually the medical examiner, Dr. Terry Haddix from Stanford University, did determine that Taser was a contributing cause of this death. And after she did so, she got a call from the sheriff coroner in Monterey County asking her to change her opinion, which she refused to do.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm just amazed by that. Wow.
I don't know. We could never prove that Taser had a direct hand in that, but they did sue medical examiners for declaratory relief in Ohio to get Taser taken off a death certificate. They've been very aggressive, not only in defending their own product this way, but also in pushing what I consider to be junk science about these deaths being due to a condition they call excited delirium.
And is there any scientific evidence to support the theory of excited delirium?
Well, it's just much more complicated than Taser makes it out to be. There are definitely people who, either because of mental illness or stimulant drugs like methamphetamine or cocaine, get into these delirious, excited, and agitated states and then wind up in conflicts with police. The police restraint procedures, which often nowadays include tasers, can aggravate the condition the person is in. By labeling it excited delirium, the police community can focus the attention more on the victim rather than on their own conduct.
John, what did you say to the jury when you summed up on the evidence here? What was it that you said that so persuaded them?
Well, I think it was so obvious that the taser had caused this death because he was tased 25 times and then turned blue and collapsed right at the end of it. And Taser absolutely refused to acknowledge that there was any causal link despite these independent tests. And I think that it was actually my co-counsel, Peter Williamson, who did the closing, who just made the point that they needed to hear a message from the jury that it was not okay for them to deny the very lethal effects of repeated taser doses.
25 times just sounds completely crazy to me. I mean, what was going on?
Well, it's a situation where police, when they get into these kind of situations, often just sort of lose their heads and a sort of a mob mentality takes over. That's what they did. They just kept holding down and pulling the triggers on these things.
But isn't it like 50,000 volts of electricity goes through your body?
Yes, but it's more complicated than that. Voltage is actually, the current is actually a fairly weak current, but it's one that even though it's a high voltage, it's a weak current. But it actually is one that emulates the kind of messages that your brain sends to your muscle. So what it does is it causes all the skeletal muscles to contract simultaneously. And that's when it repeats is what causes the problem, because a waste product of muscle contraction is lactic acid. And the lactic acid builds up in the blood, and that's what triggers the cardiac arrest, I think, in a lot of these cases.
Now, how does the trigger on the taser work? Do you have to pull it back independently for each shot, or if you hold it, does it repeatedly, is it like an automatic weapon?
Okay, the way the trigger works is that if the trigger is pulled and then released, the darts will fire and a 5-second cycle is automatically programmed in. After the 5-second cycle ends, the trigger can be pulled again and that will start another 5-second cycle. Or the trigger can be held down continuously like an automatic weapon, and current will be administered until the trigger is released. The taser has a computer chip called a data port built into it that records each trigger pull, so the data can be downloaded after an incident and the amount of trigger pulls can be determined.
Is there a limit to the number of times that trigger can be pulled?
No, not only the life of the battery, which could be 8 to 10 minutes.
Was there more than one taser being used on the person here?
Yes, three. Two were each pulled 6 times and one 13 times.
And what does that feel like, John, just to get hit with it once?
Well, people who have testified about that say that some people say it's extremely painful, like an 8 or 9 on a scale of 1 to 10. It's like that sensation that I'm sure we've all had where we've gotten shocked when we plug something in, only the electricity courses through the whole body. It's obviously continual.
Was the Taser company actually part of this case?
Oh, yes. The verdict is against Taser International.
Wow. So they had their lawyers there and everything defending it, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And what about the cops? Were they were defendants as well?
They were defendants as well, but the jury let them off. Talking to the jurors afterwards, they were very clear that the police officers had no idea that this device could be fatal.
They were never trained? You don't use it more than a few times?
Right. That was really our theory, was that Taser had not included that training. They had said it was safe regardless of how many times it was used.
Did the cops defend themselves by saying that they weren't trained?
They were trained that it could not kill. It was not a lethal device.
I'm really surprised at that, given the enormous amount of media coverage over the last few years and the report by Amnesty and the United Nations Commission on Torture, calling one of their models actually a weapon of torture, given the amount of pain that it inflicts. Isn't this just common knowledge now that almost 300 people have been killed in the United States by tasers?
It's probably closer to 400. This incident was in February of 2005, so it was early on. You know, police agencies don't listen to Amnesty International.
So what's going to happen with that police department and Taser now? Are they going to keep using them? Are there instructions that are going to happen? What's going to go on?
Well, I hope that they'll caution the officers that if the device is not effective in the first cycle or two, that they should not keep applying cycles to a person.
We're speaking with Attorney John Burton, who just got a $6.2 million verdict against Taser International for their weapon, which they claim is a humane weapon. What do you say to the argument, John, better than using a gun?
Well, I think that is, you know, I hear that all the time, and Taser's slogan is saving lives every day, but it's absolutely absurd because it's not a substitute for lethal force. They don't train that way. People who are shot with a Taser are not shot instead of a firearm. If there's a threat of great bodily injury or death, officers are going to use firearms. They're not going to use this thing.
John, I read that police are instructed to yell before they use a Taser that they're going to. In your experience, does that ever happen?
I think it does not happen enough. And the reason they're supposed to yell is to avoid sympathetic fire. When another officer's got a firearm out and then hears the pop of the Taser, there's a real danger that the officer will squeeze a round off.
Interesting.
And actually, I had a case where I believe that happened.
Now, New York City, last couple of days, I don't know if you followed, came out with a report from the RAND Corporation studying so-called reflexive shootings in New York, where lethal force is used much more widely than it should, and it didn't really explain why or why it's mostly used against minorities, particularly black people. But it did suggest that they should substitute tasers for hand out 400 or 500 tasers to cops to use instead of lethal force to avoid the so-called reflexive shooting. Any thoughts about that?
I think ECDs in general, electronic control devices, could play a constructive role in law enforcement. But, I mean, Taser is such an irresponsible company. They've got their sales and their safety kind of departments mixed up. They've been understating the dangers of the device. And then it just becomes a situation where if a device like this is given to a certain kind of officer and told this hurts like hell, but it's safe medically, then it's going to be misused. There's so many documented incidents of Tasers being used, like someone won't sign a parking ticket or something like that, when it obviously shouldn't be. That's a real problem.
Right. We've read reports about, in certain states, I think Texas and Florida, have especially high rates of taserings when all individuals do is talk back to police or don't respond immediately to a certain command. A pregnant woman, elderly, disabled, children. I wanted to ask you about conflict of interest that Taser has with law enforcement. I understand that the Taser International funded a Taser Foundation for families of officers slain in the line of duty and has funded nearly $2 million to that, as well as we've all heard of the stock options that it gave to Bernard Carrick, former New York City police commissioner, who then made millions of dollars after going around and endorsing the product to law enforcement. Are you aware if Taser International is still closely aligned with law enforcement?
Oh, absolutely. And it's reminiscent of the way that defense contractors work with retired generals and so on. They're sort of a revolving door between law enforcement and as part of their sales strategy.
It's a growth industry.
There are numerous Taser cases going on around the country. What roughly is sort of the rate of success against this giant?
Well, Taser has been putting out phony numbers. Prior to our victory last week, they claim to have won approximately 70 straight cases. But actually, there's only been one trial. There's a whole group of Tasers where police officers have been injured during training, like they've dislocated shoulders and so on when they've gotten tased as part of the training. And they've settled those cases, and then, or at least a number of them, and then they've counted those as victories, which is really bizarre logic, but it's sort of typical for Taser. Plaintiff's lawyers like myself will name the Taser at the beginning of the case and then realize that it's not a viable case against Taser. It should just be against the agency. Voluntarily dismiss it. They'll count that as a victory. And so in this fashion, they've got this padded number of 70 straight victories. But as far as I'm concerned, they're one out of two. According to their SEC statement, there's, I think, 68 more of these coming down the pike.
Good.
And was your case victorious in your mind because of the evidence that you had about the physical evidence about the effect on the human body?
Yes, and Taser's absolute refusal to acknowledge it, the validity of the science. I mean, there's two independent studies now. Both are in published peer-reviewed articles, completely independent of Taser, showing the dangerous levels of blood acid that are created from repeated Taser exposures. Taser looks at that and just says, those are pigs, those don't translate to human beings. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Do you think there was a punitive aspect to the jury verdict here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, $5.2 million is punitive damages.
Uh-huh.
They awarded $1 million in compensatory damages for the death of the son, but they reduced that by 85% comparative. They wanted to send a message that what this decedent did was not okay. I mean, he was a methamphetamine addict who had gone into a very agitated state, was trashing his parents' house.
What do you think the chances are of the punitive verdict being upheld in the appellate court?
Oh, I think we have a very solid verdict. It's five times compensatories, which is 50% of what the Supreme Court says is an appropriate proportion. The U.S. Supreme Court, right? They did the 10 times thing.
Uh-huh.
The jury was instructed on that. They had the net worth of the company, which is $120 million, and they were given, in California law, it has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. They got that instruction. So I think it's a good, solid verdict.
Well, congratulations.
That's amazing, John.
Really. I have a question for you about a New York case, and we don't know many of the facts because it's just from the New York Post. Cops go into a guy's house. They spotted a plastic bag with white powder. And when Bradway, who was the guy whose house it was, started to gulp down the powder, which may have been a drug, the cop tasered him twice, and the guy went into cardiac arrest and died. When a guy is trying to take down drugs, I mean, he's swallow drugs if you believe this post, appropriate use of taser, what do you think?
Well, I'd have to look at it more closely. There continues to be controversy over whether just a few taser shocks can actually get electricity to the heart and induce something called ventricular fibrillation, which is basically electrocution. Taser has lots of studies and lots of data that physiologically that can't happen. However, there are studies that question the validity of those conclusions. We were able to kind of avoid that controversy in our case. If it was caused by two tasings, it would not have been caused by the same mechanism that we proved in our case.
Right, we don't know whether it was 2 or 20. It's just what the post says it was 2.
Well typically, right. Police officers understate the number of tasings.
Right, I was going to
say. When we get the data port, it turns out, because in this case, the guy who pulled the trigger 13 times said he'd pulled it 3.
The taser doesn't lie because it records.
Right.
Does the distance from the taser to the victim make a difference?
The typical wires are 21 feet. They have some different distances.
It puts a little dart into you, right? I mean,
yeah, it's got a dart with like a fish hook at the end.
Oh.
A little like harpoon. The spread makes a difference.
The spread meaning?
The distance
between the darts.
Oh, you mean there's two darts that go out of each taser, right?
Right.
So if you put one in the shoulder and one in the foot, that's not as bad as putting two right in the chest, right?
Well, the larger the spread, the more effective the incapacitation.
Oh, so I'm wrong. Oh. Okay.
So are you saying that the officer can adjust something to make the spread different?
No, the spread is a function of the range.
But if you shoot from a farther distance, you're going to hit a wider spread, right?
Right, but then it becomes harder to hit the target, too.
John, if you had your druthers, would you ban this gadget altogether?
That's a difficult question. There is a... I kind of would, just given the nature of police culture in the United States. I think there's a bigger question here, which is police. I think a responsible sort of police force, it's a very effective tool in a certain situation with an irrational, delirious person to bring them to the ground from a distance, which can be safer than running in and tackling the person. But the potential for abuse is so high, given the current behavior of police in this country, I don't trust them with it.
John, what's the next step? The appeal?
The appeal, and then, I'm not real concerned about the appeal. Taser's got to kind of deal with the fact that there's 68 more of these cases coming down the pike, one of which Peter Williamson and I are also doing, and I'm in touch with a number of other lawyers who have these cases. So I think this is sort of the break in the dam, and now the flood that is Taser's just going to have to deal with.
It's been a long time coming.
Well, we worked very hard on that.
I know you did.
Congratulations. It's unusual.
It was a stunning verdict. I know you're on our National Police Accountability listserv of the National Lawyers Guild, and I have never in 9 years seen such an amazing outpouring of support and congratulations for this huge victory.
John Burton, the taser tackler.
Great, John. Really wonderful.
Thank you, and we hope to have you on again to talk more about tasers in the future.
Oh, anytime. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you,
John. I really know a lot about this device.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
That's lawanddisorder.org. Here on Law and Disorder, we've been following the case of the Cuban Five for a number of years. Last week in Atlanta, the convictions of the Cuban Five, who were serving long prison sentences, in fact life sentences in some cases, were upheld. The Cuban Five had been charged with spying and conspiracy to commit murder. The primary defense of the Five had been that they were involved in monitoring in Miami the actions of Miami-based terrorist groups in order to prevent terrorist attacks on their country of Cuba. The Five's actions were never directed at the U.S. government. They never harmed anyone, nor possessed any weapons while in the United States. Despite this, they are in U.S. prisons serving 4 life sentences and 75 years collectively after being wrongly convicted in a U.S. federal court in Miami on June 8, 2001. They are Gerardo Hernandez, Ramon Labanino, Antonio Guerrero, Fernando Gonzalez, and Rene Gonzalez. While they admitted that they were foreign agents of Cuba, which would have gotten them either a slap on the wrist or very short sentences, they actually never got any classified evidence. even looked at it, much less turn it over to the Cubans. They never involved themselves in murder or anything like that. What they did was to report on the activities of terrorists or people they believed were terrorists in Miami to the Cuban government. The case had already been up to the circuit once, and in that case, they had initially won on the grounds that the jury was not a fair jury, that you couldn't get a fair trial in Miami. They won that case with a three-judge court. It then got en banc by a full court. The full court, they lost in a huge and lopsided loss for them, saying, well, there was nothing unfair about the jury and giving other reasons. Then it went back up into this case on the actual merits of the conviction. Were they convicted on sufficient evidence? Sadly, the majority of the court said they were. They remanded three of the cases for resentencing, but not the long, really long life sentences for a conspiracy to commit murder. So it's really one of the more horrendous cases to fall out of the long U.S. hostility to Cuba. We talk now with Lenny Wineglass, famous civil rights, human rights attorney, attorney in the Chicago 7-8 case, and attorney for the Cuban Five for many, many years.
Len, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Yes, thanks for having me, Heidi.
We're actually very saddened here, as I'm sure you are, about the recent verdict from the 11th Circuit in the case of the Cuban Five. Were you surprised?
No, we weren't surprised. The verdict has a history. As you know, in the year 2005, we won a reversal of all the convictions, and we had a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit. And it was an excellent panel. Two of the judges had served for more than 25 years. They were highly respected. And they took 16 months to decide and wrote a 93-page opinion reversing all of the counts. But then the Attorney General, the former Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, ordered the case taken to an en banc review by the entire 11th Circuit. And predictably, they reversed the three-judge panel. The three-judge panel had ruled that it was a perfect storm of prejudice. And then on the same record and reviewing the same evidence, the 11 judges of the en banc court of the 11th Circuit deemed it a model trial of fairness. If you ever need a definition of political jurisprudence, there it is. So the case was then remanded because not all the issues had been decided, only venue. So it was sent back for all the remaining issues.
Len, those issues were prosecutorial misconduct?
That was the main issue. The insufficiency of the evidence on conspiracy to commit murder and insufficiency on conspiracy to commit espionage. And both of those were fairly persuasive arguments because there was very little evidence on both. This was the first trial of a conspiracy to commit espionage without a single classified document. So we were optimistic about that, and certainly we were very confident that they hadn't proved that there was a conspiracy to commit murder by Gerardo, since even the prosecution at the end of its case took an emergency appeal to the 11th Circuit, arguing that they faced an insurmountable obstacle. That was their view of their own evidence to gaining a conviction if the judge gave the instruction she intended. The 11th Circuit rejected that appeal. The judge gave the instruction, and the jury convicted anyway. So we were confident of that count as well as the espionage count.
Let me ask for a second, sorry to interrupt. The conspiracy to commit murder charge was based on an issue of whether an airplane was in international waters or Cuban waters, wasn't it?
It was even more refined than that. That was part of it. In order to make out the conspiracy charge, the government had to prove that when Gerardo entered this alleged conspiracy, and there was very little proof of that, if any, the conspiracy plan was that the planes would be shot down in international waters. Well, the government objected to that, saying, well, we've offered no evidence of what the plan was, so how could we win on that count? And that was why they went to the circuit court in an emergency writ. That was rejected, and the jury gave them a conviction on that count anyway. So we were confident that the 11th Circuit would reverse that just on the basis of the law. There was The government conceded no evidence of what the plan was. So, and it was two planes that were shot down, and four people were killed. And these were planes that were either in or about to enter a very close case, Cuban airspace. And even in the dissent in this recent decision that we just got, there was a 16-page dissent by Judge Kravitz on the count to commit a conspiracy to commit murder, saying that the Cubans were entitled, as a matter of law, to defend their airspace. And therefore, if the planes were in fact shot down in Cuban airspace, there could be no crime. That was a very interesting observation we finally got from one of our judges. But as I was saying, as we approached this three-judge panel, one of our judges, the most senior, Judge Oakes, actually, I think he's from Vermont. He was just a visiting judge in Atlanta.
He was a very liberal judge when he was on the circuit. I mean, my gosh.
Yes, there are no liberals on the 11th Circuit.
No, Oakes was from Vermont. You're right, he's from Connecticut or Vermont, and he was very liberal when I used to be in front of the circuit, sure.
Yes, he was excellent, and he's a published author and a judge and an essayist and a teacher and a scholar. I think he was very instrumental in that first go-around with the three-judge court. But he was replaced because he retired.
Right.
And he was replaced by Judge Pryor. Now, Judge Pryor has a history. When he was nominated for the 11th Circuit by Judge Bush, by President Bush, the Atlanta Constitution wrote an editorial in opposition of the nomination. And the editorial was headlined, "Right-Wing Zealot Not Fit to Judge."
That's who replaces what? Judge Oakes. Unbelievable.
When Pryor gets to the Senate rejects him, with Senator Schumer calling him, I have it right here, an ideological warrior. He was known, and you'll get a kick out of this, Michael, as the Johnny Appleseed of the Federalist Society.
He planted their seeds all over the country, huh?
Yes. Not only did he found it in the law school that he attended, but after he graduated, he traveled to various law schools, founding Federalist societies in those law schools. So he has quite a record. One of the things that troubled the Senate, and this is a direct quote, he considered Roe v. Wade the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history. So he was rejected, and his nomination was dead in the water. But if you recall, Senator came forward and worked out a compromise whereby nine judges were set aside, but three judges were approved. And one of those three was Judge Pryor. And that senator who came forward and worked out the compromise was Senator McCain.
Wow.
And so McCain, you could say, saved the seat for Judge Pryor and was, in effect, his sponsor. So there we are with Judge Pryor, and he ends up, of the three judges, writing the opinion. And the opinion is quite remarkable as a document. It really is a highly charged political statement of what this case is about. He even reaches out and makes findings and observations that weren't even in the litigation. For instance, claiming that the wife of one of the five was herself an intelligence agent of the Cuban government. And there's nothing in the record on that. It's just that she's applying now for a visa and has a separate issue to get her visa, which has been denied. So he just gratuitously makes that observation, which I'm sure will impact her ability to get a visa. So he decides the case and writes the majority opinion with a strong dissent from Judge Kravitz on the count three conspiracy to commit murder. Judge Birch, who joined with Judge Pryor, wrote a concurrence of two paragraphs. And it's a very cowardly statement, given the fact that he was so strong in reversing all the counts on venue in the earlier argument. He says merely, without saying he agrees with Judge Pryor, without saying he agrees or disagrees with the dissent by Judge Kravitz, he just says it was, quote, a very close call. Not just a close call, a very close call. That's one paragraph, without saying on what basis he goes with Judge Pryor.
This is on the conspiracy to commit murder. He said it's a very close call. Is that it?
Yes.
Len, why do you think the change of mind?
I can't tell. Judge Burge is a Federalist, a Vietnam veteran, former officer of the Special Forces, born on a military base. I think he's a Bush senior appointment. He is a conservative Republican, a member of the Federalist Society, and a Vietnam veteran in the Special Forces. His ideology always was to the right, but even he could not abide the fact that this case was tried in Miami. So I think he's ideologically close to Pryor, although honest. And as Pryor decided this case, he went with him.
The bottom line here is we had five people. They upheld the convictions of every single one of them. Is that right?
That's right. All convictions, all 27 counts.
Right. And of three of them, they remanded for sentencing. But can you just describe what the sentences are and what the three remands might be?
Yeah. The remands are of two kinds. On the conspiracy to commit espionage, where, as I mentioned, there wasn't a single classified document, the court found that since it was a conspiracy, the government did not have to prove espionage. And so they did away with any requirement that espionage occurred. As a matter of fact, at one point they point out specifically that the trial court never made a finding that top secret intelligence was ever even gathered or transmitted, which is true. So given the fact that there was no transmission or no finding of a transmission of top secret information or a gathering of top secret information, the trial judge was in abuse of the guidelines when she gave them life sentences, because the guidelines require a finding that top secret information be gathered and transmitted, and there was no finding. So the case was remanded for that. In addition...
But remanded for how many defendants in that case?
Three.
But
one was Gerardo Hernandez, who was also a defendant in count three. And the court ruled, since he already has a life sentence on count three, we are not going to remand him for a resentencing on the life sentence on count two because he's already doing life.
Uh-huh.
So the two others, my client, Antonio Guerrero, and Ramon Gonzalez, are sent back for resentencing on the conspiracy to commit espionage count.
So how low could their sentence go?
Well, they talk in terms of levels, if you're familiar
yes.
with the guidelines. Initially, the judge found a 42 level. That's life. The court said, no, it can't be 42. It has to be 37. However, in remanding it back to this judge, who maxed everyone out on every count and every charge, they sent it back to this judge so that she could make a finding if, in fact, there was a gathering of top secret information. So we're in her hands. This judge, who made repeated errors in the case, one on sentencing, one on venue, one on the instruction on the conspiracy to commit murder, all of these have been found by appellate courts. She now is going to be the final say on whether or not Ramon and Antonio do life sentence. So she has it in her hands to make that finding. No finding was made. It doesn't mean that she can't make one now. So we go back for a hearing on that issue.
Len, what's next? Will there be an appeal?
Oh, yes. We're going to request a re-argument before this panel, because a number of the things that Judge Pryor asserted in his opinion are just not in the record. And so we hope that upon a review of the accurate record, the court will be inclined to change or modify. At least Judge Burch might be inclined to change or modify his position and join Judge Kravitz, in which case the majority shifts to a Kravitz, Judge Birch majority, and Judge Pryor is in the dissenting position. As you know, requests for re-argument before a federal panel are rarely granted. We're going to file it. We're going to argue persuasively that it should be granted, but the reality is that it's rarely granted. If we lose that, then we can petition for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court on the issue of venue, which is still alive, and the correlated issues of prosecutorial misconduct and the efficacy of count three. When I say the efficacy of count three, the conspiracy to commit murder, first, there has never been a case, this is unprecedented, where an individual is accused of conspiring with members of a national air force who were protecting the airspace over the country and engaged in the shootdown. This is a first. But secondly, what Judge Pryor did in his opinion, which is the most damaging of all, he rewrote the statute, removing the requirement that there be an intent that the shootdown occur in international airspace. He said that intent requirement, he engaged in statutory construction, and as he reads the statute, that is not a requirement of the crime.
And if it happened over Cuban airspace, you could still find them guilty, according to him.
Yes. According to him, the place where the shootdown occurred determines the whole issue. So to answer your question, Michael, the government argued strongly in this case that the shootdown occurred in international airspace. It was, you're talking about seconds on either side of that border, and there was no one measuring it, although Cuban radar, the Cubans had it on radar, Cuban radar was introduced into evidence. But of course, the jury rejected Cuban expert testimony and Cuban radar. And they went with testimony offered by people who saw the shootdown, particularly a captain of a cruise ship, which of course is, I think he's a Danish or Norwegian national, dependent on the U.S. to give him a license to ply the waters off of Florida and a cruise, running a cruise operation. He testified for the government that, yes, it was in international waters.
Len, I just want to remind our audience, we're speaking with attorney Len Weinglass, and the audience should be aware that the Cubans were suffering these Brothers to the Rescue overflights over Havana and had warned the Americans many times to please stop this. And then the thing I wanted you to get into was that the Cubans, with the help of the five in Miami, had compiled a huge dossier on what the terrorists in Miami were doing to Cubans on the island. And they turned that dossier over to the FBI, hoping that the FBI would help protect them. And instead, what we got was the indictment against the Cuban five. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, what you referred to, Michael, is essentially correct. On the overflight, there were 25 overflights of Cuba in the preceding 20 months of the shootdown. But in any event, there were 25 overflights. Cuba protested each and every one to the United States. They all came from southern Florida. And they were overflying the territory of Cuba. And the Cubans finally, when the U.S. did nothing about it, they contacted a retired admiral, Admiral Carroll of the United States Navy. And he came to Cuba. And the chief of the Cuban Air Force met with him and told him that Cuba, from that point forward, would exercise its rights to defend its sovereignty, like any nation would. As a matter of fact, probably very few nations would permit 25 unauthorized overflights over its territory under any circumstances. Admiral Carroll testified to the jury, and he said he had that meeting under the advice of the Cuban Chief of Air Force. He went back and he convened a meeting in the Pentagon and the State Department, telling them that Cuba was now going to protect its airspace. But he was kind of told that, no, there was nothing that could be done politically to stop these overflights. This group in southern Florida is very powerful. And so the overflights continued, and it resulted in the shootdown by the Cuban Air Force, in which four people were killed.
Len, I think all of what we've discussed highlights perhaps the most important point, that this is a political case. The law has not been followed, and five Cuban patriots are paying for that sorely.
Yes, you're right. It's a political case in every sense of the word. People have to remember is this prosecution was not the product of George Bush. This prosecution was brought under the Clinton administration. But the Attorney General, Janet Reno, who had an intent and did, in fact, run for the United States Senate when the Clinton administration ended, had a problem because she honorably took the side of Elian Gonzalez in the dispute over the young Cuban boy who was returned to Cuba to his father. Because of that, she had won the enmity of the Cuban exile community in Miami. And this case, in a sense, which she authorized, which is unprecedented because, as I mentioned, no classified information, a conspiracy with pilots of another country. This case was put together under her aegis and brought in Miami, I believe, as a way to try to restore her credibility with that community. So it has ideology, it has foreign policy, it has intelligence, it even has Cuban political ambition in it as well.
Len, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We congratulate you for the great work that you've done in defense of the Cuban Five. And we pledge to you, Michael and Heidi and I, our listeners out there, we hope that we're behind you on this, and we hope that we can do some good, finally, on the case of the Cuban Five.
Well, thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.